Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Philosophy in Action. I'm Greg Perkins, here with philosopher Dr. Diana Shea, where we answer your questions, applying rational principles to the challenges of real life. For those listening to the podcast, please join us live, where there's a text chat to chime in with your follow-up questions and witty comments. The show airs Sunday at 8 a.m. Pacific, 9 a.m. Mountain, 10 a.m. Central, and 11 a.m. Eastern Time at philosophyinaction.com. At the site, you can also submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows and browse the archives from past shows. Now, with all of that out of the way, let's jump over to the star of the show, Dr. Diana Shea. All right. Happy Sunday.
Happy Sunday, Greg. Why don't you tell us what we have on tap?
All right. We have a great set of questions on claims of rights to food and shelter, extreme cases, being helpful to a disliked coworker, and more.
Yeah, it's going to be a good set of questions. I think we'll get through all of them, but I have a good bit of notes, particularly on that first one.
Yeah.
Folks, if you're listening live, you can post questions and comments in the text chat that's over at philosophyinaction.com/live.
Fantastic. What's been going on this week?
So SnowCon was super fun. I had such a good time. It was just like everybody who was in the condo was super awesome, and we had a great time on the slopes, and it was a really great vacation for me. And since then, I have been amazingly, like, I've been a superwoman of productivity, mostly because Andrew Zay, who was at SnowCon, and so we were talking about these kind of issues, is my productivity accountability buddy. And I now have a manager, and it's like I'm actually getting stuff done. So as a result of that,
I want one of those.
I know. Yeah. As a result of that, the book version of Explore Atlas Shrugged is almost ready. Basically, I submitted all the PDFs to Amazon's CreateSpace, and I've got my Kindle version all ready, and I'm just waiting for the proof copy, the physical proof, back to make sure that all looks good. And so I'm hoping that assuming that the proof looks good, that will be out and available next week. And I do plan to promote that and just the whole Explore Atlas Shrugged course, which you can still buy online for $20, or if you're a regular contributor, you do get for free. I'm planning to promote that with some really fun trivia contests and so on. And it's really interesting to go through and like just note all of these little details that are in there that sometimes are actually revealing. I mean, they say something about the characters or about the setting or something like that, but that are really easily overlooked. So I think we can have fun doing that, testing our knowledge of the trivia of Atlas Shrugged. So you can anytime, you can purchase the course because all the online material has all been updated with everything, all the changes that I made most recently. And so you can go do that over at philosophyinaction.com/exploreatlasshrugged or just exploreatlasshrugged.com will take you to the same place.
Sounds fantastic. Anything else going on?
And, no.
Is that all?
I'm doing a bunch
of
stuff.
Yeah.
No. But no, I'm just I've been in this superpower of productivity. I've gotten so much. I mean, I've just gotten so much done this week. So really happy about that. Yay for accountability buddies.
And is his brother coaching you on eating habits and stuff like that too?
So so Arthur's my food accountability buddy. So I'm doing a low-carb paleo. Again, I had done that. I had done a fairly strict paleo when I was in Aiken, which was really helpful. And and I decided to try low-carb again, which I haven't done in like 4 or 5 years, which is interesting. Like I'm weirdly like hungry all the time and not hungry, and I don't know what's going on. But anyway.
A little body hack action. Okay.
I know. It's a little bit hard to be hacking everything all at once. But oh well.
Well, yeah. Cool. All right. Anything else?
No, I think that's it. Let's get started.
All right. Claims of rights to food and shelter. Do people have a right to food and shelter? I recently had a conversation with a Facebook friend who stated that food and shelter are more than necessities, they are rights. I posed the question, how does one exercise their right to food and shelter? No one answered the question, so I would like to pose it here. Most food in this country is grown by farmers and sold fresh or processed by a factory for sale. If food is a right, does anyone without the means to buy these products have an inherent right to take what they need without any remuneration to the farmer or the manufacturer? The same applies to shelter. How does one exercise their right to shelter without a means to earn it? We have a right to free speech and a right to vote. One is exercised by speaking your mind on a subject without fear of government reprisal, and the other is exercised by voting during elections. We have the right to practice whatever religion we want or none at all. The press has the right to print or say whatever they want. Any right to food or shelter would have to operate differently. So are food and shelter a right? What would that mean in practice?
So basically, I do agree with the questioner here that these are not the rights to food and shelter, as these are used here, the right basically of other people to provide you with food and shelter, are not genuine rights, and that there's a real gulf, there's a real gap between things like that and the right to free speech, for example, or the freedom of religion. But I think that what we need to do here is be fair, and we need to actually look at the actual arguments that are given by the advocates of the welfare state, given by advocates of these kinds of rights, because they don't conceptualize them, they don't think of them in quite the same way, and honestly, their thinking is oftentimes a little bit muddled, and I'm hoping we might be able to clarify a little bit of that here. So the idea here, when you say somebody has a right to food or shelter or medical care or whatever it is, you're not saying that person is entitled to simply take food from the farmer or the grocery store or you know, put a gun to the head of the doctor and say, treat me or else, right? They're not saying that hey, look, you know, there's somebody who they just got evicted and they can move into a room in your house. And basically that if you resist, well, too bad, you know, I can threaten you with violence or beat you up or whatever it is to get you to allow me to stay. That's not what people are actually advocating. And so I think that although we might think that if these people understood rights to food and shelter as we understand the rights to life, liberty, and property, that would be the implication. That's not how they understand rights. And so this is not something that any advocate of the welfare state believes. It's not something that any advocate of these welfare rights believes. So let's look at what their actual views are here, what they're actually saying, what they're actually advocating. So I think the most common view is that food and shelter are such basic needs for human life, such sort of core necessities without which we are not going to live, that it's unconscionable to allow people to suffer and die because they are unable to provide for themselves. And so the idea is that what we should do is through government programs, basically through lawful means, through, you know, bureaucracy of various kinds, we should provide a safety net for the people who are most desperately needy, the people who are unable to provide for themselves. And basically the way that this is conceptualized is thinking about those most basic necessities of life, the food, shelter, medicine, and so on, as rights. And the idea here is that instead of being obliged to beg for that from others if you can't provide it for yourself, instead of receiving that as a favor, instead it's something that you ought to be provided with by law. In the same way that, you know, you ought to have your free speech rights respected. So they're trying to appeal to our notion that rights are inviolable and that the government should be out there protecting them. So they want to have that same feeling that about that same kind of process in a way about food, shelter, and medicine. You know, the government should step in and provide. And basically, this way, right, no one is in danger of slipping through the cracks. Nobody is at the mercy of other people's benevolence. And this is a duty as a civilized society to the oppressed and the downtrodden. It's a duty. And it's a duty, I think you can see, if for those of you who are familiar with the three languages of politics, which I did an interview with Paul about some months ago, you can see that this appeals to both, this appeals to the sort of conservatives who are like, you know, we need a civilized, ordered society, and so of course we have to provide a safety net because, you know, we don't want people dying in the streets. And it appeals to the liberals who are using this language of oppressor and oppressed because, you know, look, we don't want these greedy capitalists oppressing the poor and the downtrodden. And what's interesting is they're using the language of the libertarian access. They're using the language of rights to try to do that. And unfortunately, I think what this does is seriously muddy the waters in the way that the questioner has noted.
Yeah, to say the least. So what should we think of this view?
Well, so I think, first of all, I just want to say it's perfectly understandable if you are deeply concerned to see innocent people suffering and dying, particularly children, which that's certainly no fault of their own, when this is due to inadequate food, shelter, and medicine, and so on. And it's not wrong to feel compassion in these cases. It's not wrong to have a desire to help. It's not wrong to put in efforts to help, right? But claims of rights are quite another matter. these are both wrong in theory and they're destructive in practice, including to the very people that they aim to help. And this is something that I think is really critical for people who advocate these rights, who are motivated. If you're genuinely motivated by a kind of benevolence, you need to step back and say, wait, is this way of going about it by having a government safety net, and particularly by advocating these things as rights, is this actually doing more harm than good? That's something that you're obliged to think about. If you want to be truly benevolent, you need to make sure that you're not actually causing more harm than good. Okay, so one way to think about this, I struggled with how to present this for reasons that I'll talk about at the end. But one way to think about this is that you can say, look, in a sense, people have a right to food and shelter. Not in the sense that they have a right to take food and shelter from others or to be provided with food and shelter by others, but rather in the sense that they have the right to pursue food and shelter freely without interference from government bureaucrats, neighbors, or anyone else, without forcible interference. And that's actually a corollary of the right to liberty, meaning the freedom of action, including the right to contract, and property rights. So let's look at a couple examples. So let's say I want to rent out a room to my friend. I'm entitled to do that as a matter of right. It's my property, my choice. And if my neighbors object because my friend is black, well, guess what? They can suck it, right? They can tell me their opinion, but they are not entitled to stop me. It's none of their business. It's my property, right? And it's my agreement with him. Now, I'm not entitled, on the other hand, to force them to rent out their room to him. Right? That's their property. They can do with it whatever they please, even if I think it's silly or mistaken or wrong, and even if it is objectively silly or mistaken or wrong. So there's a freedom on the part of like me and my friend to pursue this mutually agreeable housing arrangement, whatever anybody else might think about that. That's none of their business. So here I am. I'm eating a low-carb paleo diet right now. And you know, guess what? I'm entitled to do that as a matter of right. It's my body. It's my money. It's my choice. And if some senator thinks that I should be eating heart-healthy whole grains, like he's free to spout that on his soapbox, but ultimately he shouldn't have any power to dictate what I eat. And he shouldn't even have these indirect powers, which the government uses so often, to control what I eat via controls on producers, you know, requiring, let's say, a certain percentage of heart-healthy whole grains in various foods and so on. That's the senator, that's the government meddling with the producer's property and their business. It's violating their liberty and property rights. So when we think about this, when we apply liberty and property rights to the necessities of food and shelter, what we see is that, gosh, by golly, like producers and consumers should be free to act without forcible interference from the government or from others. And these are the rights that enable us to pursue food and shelter and other necessities of life, secure in the knowledge that it won't be appropriated by others for some, for the benefit of some special interest group, or because, oh, look, there's some group of people that's even needier than you are, right? And we see then, if I can be secure in those liberty and property rights, then it means that it's worth my working hard because the fruits of my labor are going to be mine to retain and dispose of as I see fit. That's really critical here. So these liberty and property rights, they are a most basic necessary condition of people having access to food and shelter, because access to food and shelter means free markets in food and shelter. And if we don't have that, then we are at the mercy of voters and politicians and maybe even random thugs that are coming along and saying that, you know, they get to take my crop of potatoes this year. But here's what happens, right? Those liberty and property rights are violated. They're violated in a bajillion and one ways today, both at local, state, and federal level. And when that happens, to the extent that that happens, the government runs roughshod over people, It runs roughshod both in people as their roles as producers and in their roles as consumers. And so you have things like regulations and bans and subsidies and taxes and so on. And so people are actually forbidden by the government from acting on their own best judgment in their own interests in the pursuit of food and shelter and the other necessaries of life, with the result being that people don't have access to food and shelter and the other necessaries of life. And basically one of two things can happen. One, the government might outright forbid certain things. I mean, there's certainly regulations on the books in lots of municipalities about how many roommates you're allowed to have and so on, with the interest of, you know, making sure that people aren't running brothels. So it's, you know, it's awfully hard to catch people running brothels, apparently. But we'll just forbid, you know, five or more people from living in the same house, that kind of thing. So that's one thing that happens. The other thing that happens is because they basically add on regulations that raise the cost of housing and shelter or whatever it is. Or they deplete people of their resources via taxation so that people don't have sufficient funds to buy food and housing and so on. And we see this time and time and time again. So take government building codes, for example. These are not about basic safety. These are not about making sure that your contractor isn't defrauding you. Or that, you know, you're going to set your neighbor's apartment on fire, right, because the electric is so wonky. These are way, way beyond that. They're demanding bells and whistles that raise the price of housing beyond the capacity of many to afford, whether you're looking to purchase or whether you're just looking to rent. And I saw this when I was building my barn, because my electrician, he's a cool guy, and so he and I were chatting and about these kinds of things. And there's just this been this explosion of regulations that he has to comply with that raise the cost of everything. You know, my receptacle now costs $80 rather than $30. And, you know, that makes a difference when you're building a house or a barn or whatever it is. You also see zoning regulations that they price poor people out of whole areas. Or take another example. One of the things one of the regulations that liberals are apt to pass are regulations that limit a landlord's power to evict tenants. You know, they give, you know, you're going to have a process, and it's going to be like, first you've got to give 30 days notice, and then you've got to try to go to arbitration, and then you've got 60 days and blah, blah, blah. So basically it's really hard to get non-paying tenants out of a building. And this is supposedly in the name of protecting renters against unscrupulous landlords. But think about what the effect on landlords is. Think about what you would do if you were a landlord. You would not wish to take a risk on anybody. You wouldn't want to rent to somebody who was poor, or maybe a person with a checkered past, or maybe somebody without the greatest credit history, because you know that if you do that, you are going to be in danger of being saddled with them for 6 months with non-payment of any rent at all. And that might not be something you can afford, right? You have your own mortgage to pay. And so this basically, a lot of these regulations, particularly even the ones that are in the name of protecting the poor, are often, if you do just sort of straightforward law and economics analysis of these, actually really, really damaging to the poor. So surprise, surprise, government acts, government behaves badly. Now, the only way to prevent these kinds of government controls, which, again, they're often superficially aimed at protecting people but are really, really harming them, and this is particularly burdensome to the poor, is to uphold liberty and property rights. That way, if you do that, entrepreneurs and other producers are free to offer innovative, cheap housing options that put decent shelter, for example, within the reach of the poor. But once you grant the government the power to meddle, they're going to simply meddle more and more and more. It's very rare that the government says, "Oh, we've decided we don't need these 300 regulations. Let's just get this down to 20." Right? That doesn't happen without a lot of social pressure. And so it's a really slippery slope once you grant that. Once you accept that the government has this power to meddle, to violate people's liberty and property rights, then you very quickly get to exactly the kinds of problems and exactly the kind of dynamic that we see today. Now, let's look then at safety nets, because these are regarded as a hallmark of benevolence, right? If you don't advocate for safety nets, for government safety nets, that means you want the poor to die. But A, that's an unjustified inference. And it's also what these are, in fact, are a very dangerous form of meddling. I mean, most obviously, funds for that safety net, they have to come from somewhere. They have to come basically from tax revenue. And that means you are violating people's rights to their own property. You're violating the very rights that are absolutely necessary for people to access food and shelter and obtain the other necessaries of life, right? You're only getting those tax dollars by violating these fundamental principles. And one of the things you're doing in that regard is you're making people poorer so that they're unable to help. So like, even if like I can still afford housing, even if I have a, you know, 20 or 25% or 30% tax rate, whatever it is, you're making those people poorer so that they are unable to help hardworking people who are in need, right? They have less money, they have less disposable income that they could use for charitable efforts. And they also have less capital, which could be used and would be used to some extent in the development of businesses. So in other words, providing jobs for people, building of houses, innovation in food production, all of these other great things that you see in a capitalist system. The other thing that we see, and this is, I think, far less obvious to people, is that these government safety nets discourage hard work. They discourage ambition and frugality and other virtues and positive qualities that enable people to lift themselves out of poverty. And this is a point that Henry Hazlitt made in Economics in One Lesson, which I highly recommend to anybody who wants to understand basic economics. Okay, so here's the deal. Suppose that Joe is unemployed. And so the government says, hey, look, we've got a safety net here. We're going to pay you, let's say, $50,000 a year so that you are able to buy food, pay the rent, and et cetera. So you can survive, right? Now, the ideal image of Joe here is that he really wants to work. He's out there, pounding the pavement, but he's just unable to find it. And so these welfare payments, they prevent him from starving and so on. Now, let's say, imagine we have Bob. Now, Bob isn't super skilled. Maybe he's young. Maybe he got a crappy education, whatever. But right now, he's working his rear off for $20,000 per year. Like, he's not making a good income at all, but he's able to pay his own way. He lives frugally. And so he's not getting any welfare checks from the government. He's below their threshold. Well, Bob looks over and looks at Joe, and he says, well, damn it. If I got myself fired, I could be like Joe. And then I would get $15,000 a year from the government. So think about the implications of that, right? Bob is, in fact, working his rear off for just $5,000 a year, because that's the difference that working versus not working makes on his finances, in fact. And that is deeply unfair to Bob. It devalues his work. It gives him, in fact, an incentive to quit and go on the dole. Now, we're imagining here Bob is a hardworking guy, and he would never want to do that, but if Bob is going to keep working, it has to be working against the incentives of the system. And most people are not going to do that, and even the best of people cannot always do that forever. It just, at some point they give up. And what happens then is basically welfare programs, they create this dynamic. And then, by gosh, by golly, our welfare rolls are ever rising, and so many more people are on welfare than ever before. And here we thought we just had 10,000 people in our city to help, but now suddenly we have 100,000 on our welfare rolls. And then look, we have this underclass of people who they're not even thinking about working, and they get mired in poverty, and their children are raised this way, and so on. These people, and they end up thinking of work as something for suckers, right? Because you can always fall back on that safety net. So basically, these welfare programs are deeply destructive to the very people that they aim. They mire them and their children in poverty, and in a kind of poverty that's not just of the body, but a kind of poverty of the soul, a degrading poverty of the soul, where you're eroding people, you're destroying people's character and ambition. And yes, people can overcome that, and they do, and I admire those people immensely, because that requires a kind of Herculean effort to overcome all the incentives that the government is providing to simply stay poor and sort of live in that cesspool. Okay, so let me just clarify one point. I'm not saying that nobody should help the poor because that turns them dependent, right? People are not bears. I'm not. I don't have like a don't feed the bears, like don't feed the poor sign, right? I'm all in favor of helping hardworking people who've fallen on hard times and are really struggling to get their lives back in order. And I've done that myself, or actually, I'm actually still doing that. There's a young Objectivist man who I've known online for a number of years, and he's actually been living in his car for quite a while now. And he ran into some serious trouble with because he had a title loan. And in that case, like, I know him. I know the effort that he's going through. I know how difficult the circumstances are that he has come out of. And I'm perfectly willing to help. And I'm not just willing to help because it's my own choice, right? I'm not being forced by the government. I think that's important, right? But because I know that he is struggling hard to get him out of this, to get himself out of this hole and to become financially stable and independent. And that matters to me, to see that up close, to see somebody working that hard to overcome these obstacles is actually really inspiring to me. And it's worth the investment of money that I have made in him. But that's a really far cry from government welfare programs. That's not what government welfare programs do. They're not selective in that way. And the only way that you can actually help people with due respect for the rights of everybody in a way that actually really, really helps them is for individuals and charities to use their own discretion and their own funds to help people. And the problem is that far too many people think that, well, there is a moral duty here to help the poor, right? And if I've advocated for government welfare programs, like, case closed, I'm done, I'll pay to my taxes, and then I don't have to think about it anymore. And so they're doing actually nothing to help good people out who are in need. And in fact, they're harming the very people that they aim to be benevolent towards. And that's not cool, right? That's not kosher. That's not enough. People, we need to be a little bit more morally attentive here. And there are tons of ways, even if you have, you know, even with all of these government programs, if you want to help the poor, people who are struggling, there's plenty of ways to do that right now, particularly thanks to the internet. We have crowdfunding projects, we have microloans, we've got a bunch of other stuff that makes it really easy to see somebody who has fallen on hard times and connect with that and say, hey, look, I'm gonna help you out and send you $20. And that can really add up. That can really make a difference for somebody. Ultimately, I would say, if you care about the plight of the poor and you wish to help, then what you have to do is advocate for the rights to life, liberty, property, contract, and the pursuit of happiness, meaning for markets free of government controls and subsidies. And that means rejecting all of these welfare rights, like the right to be provided with food and shelter. And it is really an either-or scenario. You can't have both. Because if you have welfare rights, the only way you get those rights is by violating people's liberty and property rights. So if you end up rejecting the principle of liberty rights in order to get your welfare programs, then, yeah, you know, the result is going to be that government is going to make life impossible for the poor and difficult for everybody else in countless ways. And then the government's going to come in and say, oh, look, it's so terrible, we need to come in and help more. And you will simply have a really bad downward spiral of government programs worsening economic conditions, more government programs worsening economic conditions. So that's my general take on this. I hope that was illuminating. Greg, you haven't said anything in a very long time, so go ahead and
I'm just hanging back and watching you do this nice riff. And it was very good, a lot of good points. And I liked your approach of actually going off and looking at the way the advocates of this are thinking about it and folding in your understanding from the three languages of politics. So that was really nice. A lot of material. What's the take-home point?
Okay. So take-home point, Har. Sorry, I'm having to scroll in my notes. So the only right to food and shelter that people actually have is the right to pursue food and shelter by their own efforts and voluntary trade with others. Government welfare programs violate those rights, and worse, they do serious harm to the poor. So I do want to make one meta comment before we do any follow-up questions here. This is a really easy question to just give a sort of standard libertarian / objectivist answer, you know, in terms of positive or negative rights or welfare and liberty rights, and, you know, just sort of hammer on that language of politics for one, right? And so, but last night I'm working on this, and I felt like I was going too much in that direction. And I'm trying, like, how can I reconceptualize this? How can I bring it, you know, talk about it from another angle? And I don't know that this was entirely successful, let me just say. I did all right here, but I think that there's so much work to be done of figuring out how to present the case for liberty rights, property rights, basically the right to life, liberty, happiness, pursuit of life, liberty, property, and the pursuit of happiness, and so on, in a way that really is comprehensible to people and really is compelling to people who don't already share our viewpoint that rights are the most important thing. So for those of you who are, that's sort of a message for those of you who already agree with me. Anyway, I just think it's something I'm interested in, it's something I'm working on, and I think you know, even having just given this, more and better is possible.
Excellent. All right. A little bit of follow-up action here. KPOMS, Is there a more subtle version of this argument? Is there a right to resources, i.e. does someone have a right to air or a right to access to water?
The reason we don't have a right to air, this actually came up, there was a discussion of this at SnowCon. What was it about? It was relative to, was it minimum wage laws? Arthur was having an argument about this online. And
Did he go in the direction of saying, look, that's not an economic value because it's a free resource. It's
we have plenty of it.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
there is no price for air because we have pretty much an effectively infinite supply of it here.
But notice, like, you concentrate air, like you concentrate, oxygen or something like that, and suddenly that's a value, right? Because there's work, there's labor required to take it from its natural state and put it in that kind of form. Arthur was arguing about
going to a place where it's not freely available, right? The moon or underwater.
Right, right. Arthur was actually, we were talking about water rights, and so that's a difference, right? Water, and this is one of the points Arthur made, water in its natural state is not super helpful to humans. We need to do a lot to make that useful to us, to water our crops, to water our livestock, to do all of these other kinds of things.
It's a different place. You have to make it safer by removing organisms that'll kill you, and so on.
You've got to actually pipe it into your house and so on. So it requires a lot of work, which is why we do have this whole legal structure around water rights. Now, I think a lot of that legal structure is very bad, and a lot of it is, instead of actually using a rights-based structure, which is what Colorado does for the most part, we have a pretty well-developed system of water rights here, a lot of places basically try to use rationing and so on, which is why they have droughts.
Pro tip for everybody who wants to talk about rationing. Rationing causes shortages.
Yes.
Read some Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson. I think we'll straighten you out a little bit on that.
Good. Yeah. The question, I should look at the question again that was just asked here because
I feel
like I lost that thread.
Is there a more subtle version of this in saying that, maybe people don't have a right to food and shelter. Maybe they have a right to resources like air and water.
I don't think so. Like, I just think those are arguments for welfare rights, or they're, because you can advocate for water. You can advocate for water as a welfare right, or there's just something super funky going on, or it's like a right to water in the sense of like I have a right to produce that and trade that and so on. Which
I guess it only becomes interesting when somebody says they have a right to an economic good. As soon as you're pointing at an economic good, then you're going down the path that you talked about earlier of stepping on people's genuine liberty rights.
Right.
So because an economic good has to be produced, like water, which has to be purified and moved to where it's needed.
Right.
Different than air, which is everywhere and doesn't need to be fixed up.
Right.
All right, so moving on. To what extent is this government depriving people of resources by way of regulation? Is it deliberate versus unintended, Fabian asks?
I think there's a real bootleggers and Baptists dynamic that goes on pretty much in all of these government regulations. And if you don't know what that refers to, for one, Google it right now. There's an article, classic article on this, which basically explains how bootleggers and Baptists joined forces in order to prohibit alcohol because it was in both of their interests. So you have sort of the ideological people who are motivated by ideology, and they are joined by people who, in a nasty, smarmy kind of way, would benefit by the regulation. And so you have, I think a lot of times you have this, look, we have to help the poor, we have to do this and that. And then you also have the businesses that see, oh, look, this would be a cash cow for us if we had this particular government program. And so you oftentimes have this joining of forces of the bootleggers and the Baptists.
It does seem to describe a lot of government regulation where it's like, oh yeah, we're going to do that to help people, and we're going to clean up over here.
And I will say the government is the other thing that you see is this. On the one hand, we need to protect the middle class, and that includes like protecting the middle class from exposure to the poor, right? Sometimes to crime risk and so on, right? There's legitimate issues there. But then on the other hand, we really have to help the poor, and so there's ways in which the government is, quote unquote, helping the middle class, let's say by zoning regulations, that, you know, aim to protect property values and so on, which are actually really damaging to the poor. And then they're like, well, crap, okay, so we've got to go help the poor now since we, you know, we just did. Look at the poor. They're in even more desperate straits than before. How did this happen? Oh, we better go have another welfare program. So what I would...
Pattern you've said a couple of times now, this pattern of intervention begets intervention. I think people want the reference on that. It would be The Road to Serfdom.
Okay.
Is the name of the book.
I haven't read that, actually. You know, I just think there's if we were going to do one thing to start rolling back the welfare state that maybe everybody could agree upon, maybe, right, except for maybe the real ideologues, is to start doing effectiveness testing on government welfare programs. Like, let's just see if this actually benefits people or not. Like, here we're spending a bunch of money. Let's make sure that this is actually making a positive difference in people's lives. And if it's
not,
would
actually be interesting to say, if you want a welfare program, you have to have a metric, and it sunsets if it doesn't meet the metric.
Yep.
That would be pretty interesting. I think we'd see every single one of them just fall off the.
I think you'd see quite a number. I mean, I don't think all of them, because I do think some welfare programs at least seem to help people, right? And there's ways of doing them that are less destructive and so on. But I think that you would see a dramatic reduction. And what I would like to see is just a different attitude about this, like that it's just not enough to have benevolent motives here. That look, if we're gonna be doing this, we should at least make sure that we're actually doing some good. And the other thing, let's say maybe the second one should be, could private charity do this, right? And if private charity could do this, maybe the government is going to, you know, turn over operations to a private charity, and that would be like another step. But I do think a lot of the welfare state is very, very ideologically motivated. And there are certainly people who are adamantly opposed to any testing of the effectiveness of government program. Like they're offended by the very prospect that we would do this. But I do think sort of the majority of Americans are more reasonable, and that would actually seem to be something reasonable that they should do.
Let's see. And related to something you were talking about earlier, Lauren asks, is charity in severe cases selfish in that it reduces risk of crime? I have actually heard people use this argument. It's like, well, if we didn't have these safety nets, then we would be overrun with crime.
Right, which is A, not true, and B, you shouldn't – that's basically like giving into the terrorist, right? I mean, it's one thing to say, look, we want to help It's you don't want to be giving people essentially welfare, whether government or private charity, just to prevent them from going out and committing crimes. Like, that is not what needs to happen. But if your idea is, look, what we want to do is make sure that inner city kids are well educated so that they can graduate high school and actually have potential professions. Like, they can have career paths, they can have trades, they can have skills that will enable them to go out and get work. And thereby, you know, you would reduce the crime rate that way. That's great, right? If you're helping to make people into honest, productive citizens rather than, you know, leaving them on the streets and engaging in criminal activity, that's all good. But buying off criminals is not in anybody's self-interest.
Yeah. You need to buy our protection. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. So moving on, it's time for the reminder about the tip jar.
Yeah, so Philosophy in Action Radio, not just the live show, but the podcast too, is available to anyone free of charge. That's because we want to spread rational principles far and wide. We do that with each and every show to thousands of listeners, but we can't do that alone. We do rely on the support of our fans. So if you value our work, please contribute to our tip jar. You can visit philosophyinaction.com/support to send money online or via the mail. We suggest $5 per episode or $20 per month, but any amount is welcome. Also, you can create a recurring monthly tip via PayPal, Dwolla, or your bank's bill pay. Then you don't need to remember, and we really appreciate that regular support. Again, you can do that all at philosophyinaction.com/support.
Extreme cases. Do moral principles break down in extreme cases? When faced with bizarre hypotheticals, advocates of rational egoism often assert that such scenarios would never happen. This seems to be dodging the question. It's said that conventional understandings of physics break down at microscopic and extremely grand scale levels. Does morality follow a similar pattern? For example, what if a small society of people stranded on an island faced a shortage of clean water, and a single individual who owned all access to clean water refused to sell it? Is that really impossible? Doesn't that show that the principle of individual rights breaks down in extreme cases?
Oh, sorry, I'm at the wrong place in my notes. Okay, this is a good question. This is a good question. I'm going to enjoy answering this. So it's definitely wrong if an ethical egoist says these scenarios just can't happen, right? The fact is, yeah, people do get stranded on lifeboats and they're faced with hard choices about what to do. More commonly, what I've heard egoists say is that, look, such scenarios are so uncommon and so unusual as to be, one, not a proper basis for ethical principles applicable in ordinary life, and perhaps, two, not even worth thinking about because the likelihood that I'm going to encounter this situation in my lifetime is just minuscule. And I do agree with that, but nonetheless, let's forget number two and let's think about these cases, right? Because I'm a philosopher and we like dealing with the hard cases. Well, they're fun. They're
interesting. Yeah, and it's I think it's okay to think about them, just not first, not as the center of the problem. You should say, okay, now that we have a basic understanding, let's go look at these hard cases and make sure we're okay.
Yeah, and I do think the reason to go think about these and analyze these cases is because people like this questioner raise concerns about them. They raise concerns about the scope of ethical principles using these kind of cases. So that's illuminating. Yeah. That's interesting.
Okay, so let's back up a little bit. Why aren't cases like this relevant to ethics then? That's part one.
Yeah, so ethics is about guiding our choices and actions. And if we're going to get good principles about how to do that, we need to focus on the kinds of choices and actions that we all commonly face. So this means that the ordinary scenarios of life, the scenarios we face in work, in love, dealing with family and friends and pursuing our hobbies, these kinds of things, these are going to be the basis for our ethical principles. Basically, our ordinary scenarios are going to give us the data, the epistemic foundation for our principles that are going to apply to those kinds of ordinary cases, right? Those principles might not apply, or they might not apply straightforwardly in scenarios like war, dictatorship, famine, natural disasters, and so on. And conversely, the principles that we would employ for those extreme situations might not apply or might not apply straightforwardly for the ordinary scenarios. I mean, it's not all that different in a way. It's simply a difference in degree that sometimes the principles that you employ, let's say, in dealing with your coworkers are not the same as the principles you employ in dealing with your romantic partner. Or there's differences, like there's some similarities, but there's differences in application, right? But if you treated your romantic partner in the way that you treat a coworker, you might have some problems in your romantic life. You really might. Or if you treat it, I think it might be even worse to treat your coworker like you would your romantic partner. That might be even, that's going to be grounds for a sexual harassment lawsuit real quick, right?
Get a visit from HR quickly, yeah.
Right. So it's not that there's a breakdown of principles. It's just that maybe there's a lack of application or a different kind of application due to different contexts here. Now, this is, notably, just to get it back to the question, this is basically the same as physics, right? Macro-level laws might not apply to the atomic or subatomic levels, and it's just not a huge deal so long as we recognize here's the context we're working with, so these are the relevant applicable principles, or here's how these principles apply in this context.
All right. So, and what about the scenario that was given here of the people stranded on the desert island where one person owns all the water?
Okay, so now this is unrealistic. It's not unrealistic in the sense that, well, people would never be stranded on a desert island with a limited water supply, right? That can happen. But rather, how the heck would this one jerk come to own all the water, right? What, he you know, your lifeboat landed and he ran up to it and set his pack down next to it and said, it's mine.
Yeah, calling
right?
dibs does not make you an owner.
Right.
Sorry. That's not the way property works.
Right. So even, and I would say, even if he worked to discover it, like he was the one who hiked out and discovered it, and then maybe he built a dam or did something to improve it, he can't be said to have a right to it. There is no private property on this island, except maybe the personal property that you brought with or items that you make. Not until we have an agreement among the people on the island about how we're dividing things up, right? The land is just in a state of nature. People don't have property in, you know, like where they happen to put their tent. And so there is no obligation to respect the say-so of this idiot. He does not, in fact, have a right to the water source.
All right. So can we identify moral principles that would apply on that desert island? So even if that's not realistic.
Yeah, so let's talk about what would be the case on this desert island, what kind of moral principles might apply, since we're not going to say he's got a right to property. What does that mean? It's anything goes, right? Well, what I want to do here is think about some lifeboat scenarios in general. And these are just some kind of preliminary thoughts, not remotely comprehensive. Honestly, I don't think it's worth developing a comprehensive set of principles, not only because these scenarios are so rare, but also because there's so many differences in different types of lifeboat scenarios. Like, I don't think on the lifeboat you need a manual that's packed, like an ethical manual that's packed with, like, here's all the things that you should be doing, here's the relevant principles, you know, this if you're in a, you know, if you're in a fire, and this if you're stuck in a blizzard, and this if you're on the lifeboat, right?
Yeah, or if you, like, it's back to the problem is that these are so rare,
right,
that it's probably not worth your effort to focus in and create a whole manual and then go and learn the manual.
Right. Yeah, problem. This is the problem with these, and put that in scare quotes, that these situations are actually rare. Okay. So, but nonetheless, I do think we can say some general principles that are actually the same general principles that we want to live by in our everyday life, or similar principles in, you know, in certain contexts. First of all, I think as a default and as an ideal, you land on the desert island, right? The goal should be to save everyone, right? So it's reasonable to say, look, we're all kind of in a state of nature with respect to the resources that we happen to have, you know, on this lifeboat. So it makes sense to share those resources equally. Or maybe what you do is prioritize the sick so that they have a better chance of making it through as well. And I also think, look, every person should be contributing. Every person should be working as they're able to do, because that's what decent people do. They don't loot from others, and they don't mooch off of others.
So you're all in an emergency. You'd like everyone to get out, and it's pretty reasonable to say, okay, everybody should help here. We got to get out of this, and the really hurt or sick people, we have to focus on them a little bit because they're having a harder time.
Right. But now imagine a case. You can imagine a different kind of scenario where not everybody would be in equal standing relative to the resources that they brought in and relative to their effort. So imagine some kind of natural disaster where half the people prepared diligently, like they had gathered resources and so on, while others either were oblivious to the risks or they evaded them, or maybe they just expected other people to save them, right? And in that case, I don't think you have a sort of share and share alike model, because you don't have, these resources are not then in the state of nature. The resources are the property
of one set of
people, right? And in that case, I think it would be generous for the prudent planners to share to some degree. And they might reasonably choose to do so in exchange for work, but it wouldn't be obligatory. And certainly, if a person is unwilling to work, and this is true in either scenario, they're not entitled to sponge off the resources of others, right? Again, moochers do not deserve the reward of a good dinner.
So this kind of thing would be the first point you made would be the plane just crashed. And we're in the first, it's the first couple days of, like, let's just get to a place where we can be identified, keep everybody in one piece, and we'll get rescued.
Right.
What you're talking about now is we've been here 3 or 4 weeks, and we're having to do work to create what we need to live.
Right. Potentially, yeah.
And if you're not helping, hey, you know.
Right.
And
I do think there are also points, like, if you have been on that desert island for weeks and your food is running out and there seems to be no hope of rescue, no hope of rescue today any more than there was yesterday, you might change your strategy to triage. You might say, well, look, sorry, sick people, but we cannot afford to continue expending these resources on you. We are going to try to help the most strong and capable and healthy to survive, because they're the ones who are going to continue to be able to do the work, let's say hunt or fish or, bring back water or whatever it is, so that they will, at least somebody will be able to live until the rescue happens.
So you have a change in attitude from,
we've
got to get everyone out of here, to, we're not all going to get out of here. Okay, we can't kill everyone to get nobody out.
Right. Let's at least have some people live.
Yeah.
So whatever the details of the emergency of the lifeboat scenario, a decent person should want to be an honest trader, not a moocher or looter. A person should want to be rational, not ruled by emotions of fear or panic, and not engaged in power lusting and that kind of thing. A person should be just. They should aim to respect people's judgments and efforts and property. A person should seek out win-win relationships. They shouldn't be trying to collect sacrifices from other people. A person should remember that other people are a huge value, that survival alone is really, really unlikely and incredibly difficult. And basically, one way to think about this is a person should protect his character so that he, at the end of this, will be a person who is worth rescuing. And I think that's really important. This is why, for example, as an ethical egoist, I think that it would be far better to die at the hands of the Nazis than to collaborate with them and save your own skin. Because at the end of that collaboration, you are not a person who's worth saving. Yeah. And I think that's something that's a sort of meta-ethical principle that's really worth thinking about in these kinds of difficult scenarios.
And a lot of what you just listed are straight out of the heart of the principles that you would be studying in everyday action. So
yep.
they do apply in these circumstances.
Exactly.
The summary I have for myself is you should prioritize yourself, but not by taking direct action against others. So I might not share my food because I need to live, but I won't steal yours to keep myself alive, because then I have destroyed my character and now I'm not really worthy of living.
Right.
I don't want to live under those circumstances.
Right.
I just wouldn't do it.
Right. And I think that's a principle that the ethical egoist should be living by in ordinary, regular, everyday life as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So what should you do if a person on the desert island claims a right to the only fresh water?
There's yes. Yes.
Yeah, so, dibs.
So the thought is, in light of these principles, right? Okay, what do we do when the guy, the jerk, is like, it's my water. I've had my, you know, I've got my tent here. It's mine. I would basically say you get to ignore him because there is no such right. You could try excluding him from other benefits of the group, basically treat him as an outcast. But if worse comes to worst, tie the jerk up and take his water. I'm trying to get excited.
Not his water.
And I'm saying all the wrong things. So tie the jerk up and take the water if necessary, because it is not his. It's not his by right, and he has no right, in fact, to prevent others from using it.
Okay. Note to self, don't cross Diana. Lost. All right, so what's the take-home point?
So lifeboat scenarios are not particularly relevant to the core of ethics, yet many of the basic principles of ethics still apply, even in those kinds of desperate circumstances.
Indeed. All right, follow-up questions. You know, let's see, we're not seeing it. It was just so brilliant and clear, nobody had any follow-ups. So what have you been listening to or reading lately?
So I've actually been re-listening to the whole of Jane Austen's corpus. And
you do this
just
about once a year, don't you?
Well, once every two to three years. And I'm finishing up with Mansfield Park now, and I think I haven't read them in 3 years. And my thought when I first started was just like, oh, God, this is amazing. Like, I'm so glad to be reading these again. And what particularly struck me this time throughout pretty much all of them was the depth of psychological insight and how there's these differences between the characters and in their sort of fundamental core way of being. And we see how that affects their thinking and choices. I mean, it's just always such an interesting tour. It's always such a way of coming to understand people and their differences and it's like a tour through people's minds. And that's something that I really love about her work, about how insightful that is and how so much of that still applies today, even though the kinds of social mores are so very different.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So, by the way, what's the deal with Audible?
Yeah, so I'm listening to these from my Audible versions. And if you want to do the same, I actually particularly, for people who haven't read Jane Austen, I really recommend doing audiobook versions, because there's so much subtle humor and intonation and so on that you might miss if you're just trying to read them, particularly if you're not used to reading Victorian and Georgian era novels. There's a lot of satire or just sort of light comic things, like people being ridiculous, that you will be able to notice immediately if the book is being read to you, whereas you might not pick that up if you're reading it yourself. So this is why I particularly recommend listening to these books on Audible. And if you are wanting to do that, Philosophy in Action offers a free 30-day trial with the fabulous audiobook seller audible.com. To check that out, just go to philosophyinaction.com/audible. It's a win for you, and it's a win for us.
All right. So, hey, one more, but it looks like a pretty quick one. What do you think?
Yeah, let's go ahead and do it. If you've got the time.
All right. Being helpful to a disliked coworker. Should I do something nice for a coworker I dislike? There's a lady at work that I dislike. My conflict with her is merely a conflict of personality. I find her defensive, passive-aggressive, and awkward to the point of rudeness. I'm also not very impressed with her work products, but rarely has that had a direct impact on me, except when I'm asked to review them, as is the fact that she only seems to work for about 6 hours every day. Indirectly, of course, her eccentricities and poor work quality cast our team in a very poor light and could eventually serve as a reason to dissolve or lay off our team. It's a mystery as to why she hasn't been fired. But I'm not her manager. In a meeting earlier today, she made a remark that she thought she was being excluded from important meetings that are relevant to her work. The truth is that she's not being actively excluded from these meetings, but rather everything is happening so fast and the meetings aren't always planned, so it's really just not possible to include her in those meetings. She would probably be heartened to understand how these events take place in our company. She's rather new and I'm very tenured. She might feel better about her position, and she might become less defensive about these things if she had a better understanding of the organizational mechanics here. But I strongly dislike her and would prefer that she seek other employment. Should I be kind and explain those mechanics or not?
So, first of all, you have no duty to help here, right? This is optional. You know, it's not your responsibility to help her out. But I do think if her poor work threatens your team, it might be worth doing. And heck, she might be a little bit less annoying as a result too. And, you know, granted, from the way you describe her, that sounds a bit unlikely, but, you know, we could be hopeful, maybe. Maybe it'll happen. But I actually think that the way to do this is not to go and talk to her directly, particularly given what you've described of her character, because she might react very poorly. And particularly she might react very poorly if she hears it from you, right, as opposed to from her manager. And you just don't want her craziness or her defensiveness or whatever else she might lash on you. You just don't want that. There's no reason to invite that. Right.
Yeah, don't invite that. So what should this person do then?
Instead, what I would recommend is going to your manager, and you might need to go to her manager if your manager isn't the same as her manager. The reason to do that is because it's his job to manage this employee, right? It's not yours. And I think what you need to do here is be just super casual and benevolent and say something like, "Hey, Bob, I noticed that Joan doesn't seem to understand that a lot of meetings are on the fly, and so I've seen her get upset when she's not included or she didn't know that the meeting happened. And I don't want to butt in here, right? You know, this is not my job. But in case you weren't aware of that, I wanted to tell you so that you could go talk to her at your next meeting." And that's that.
Yep, pretty good.
Right? Yeah. It's critical. You shouldn't be disparaging her in this. Again, be very casual, very benevolent. It is not your place to assess her work or to make snippy comments about her person or how dumb she is or whatever it is when you're doing this. So frame this in a benevolent way, but hey, look, it's just not my responsibility to do it. And I think what you need to do here to do this effectively is cultivate that kind of emotion in yourself before you talk to your manager, particularly if you're super, don't go talk to your manager if you're super frustrated with her at that very minute. Like, be in a chill mood and think about how frustrating it would be if you were in her position not knowing what's going on here. And go to the manager with that kind of attitude. Obviously, I think if she's doing active harm to your team, you might want to document that. You might want to bring those to your manager as concerns. But again, it's their problem to deal with her and her problems. It's just not yours.
It's
and I know
their job.
Yeah,
they can do their job.
Yeah, I know that the person who asked this question would not attempt to get her fired in that way. But just for anybody else who's thinking about these kind of situations when you super duper hate somebody at work. Not your job to get them fired. Also, I do think as a matter of general policy, even though there's no duty to help, I think it's better to err on the side of benevolence. If you have been perfectly benevolent and the person still acts like a jerk, then, well, you know that it's entirely his problem and it's not you, right? Whereas if you've been a jerk first and then the person acts like a jerk, it's just a bad cycle and it could be that it's that you're part of the problem here. Right, and I also think that general policy of benevolence, it makes you more generous, it makes you more patient, more tolerant person at work, which is a genuine value to you that will make your work life more pleasant and easy and successful. And it also fosters a workplace culture in which minor annoyances and abrasions don't explode into big, nasty personal messes. And that is a huge, huge value. So think about, you know, the kind of workplace that you want to have here, even if you really don't like that person. I think that can make a difference.
All right, what's the take-home point?
So while you have no duty to help, you might err on the side of benevolence. Don't speak to her directly, but instead speak to her speak to your manager and hers too, if necessary.
All right. No real follow-up action. Pretty straightforward. Cut and dried. Moving on. We have time for one rapid-fire question. We're going to put Diana on the hot seat. I'm going to pick this one at random.
You better pick the first one.
Okay. I was going to pick that one. Not because you said, because I just thought it was funny.
It was pretty funny.
Okay. Here's the question. Is it ever the case that somebody who's being really annoying just deserves to be socked in the face?
I love the socked, right? Not punched in the face, but socked.
That's a good word.
This is funny, and I have no problem with saying this in a colloquial way, because you don't.
Of course, what makes it funny is that it's absurd. Yeah,
right.
That's why it's funny.
Right. But no, this is not literally true. And if you do this, look, there's lots of annoying people in the world, and guess what the proper reaction to this is? Move away from them. Create distance in between you and them.
Yeah.
If you sock them in the face, you have committed assault. And if you do, like, if you do something like break a bone, it's like aggravated assault. And if they die, you actually are responsible for their murder because, you know, even if like they had something like hemophilia or something like that and you didn't know, nonetheless, the way assault works is you're actually liable for that. So like, why would you do that? And also you're going to get fired if this was on the job.
And you're a horrible person. I mean, you committed a crime in response to somebody merely being annoying.
I know.
When you could have just walked away.
And merely being annoying. Like, this is not somebody who's vicious and evil and, you know, torturing puppies. Like, this is just somebody who's annoying, but you don't want to move your feet and get out of there. Dude, no.
Yeah.
Don't.
So get some self-control. Don't be a thug. I mean, there are annoying people out there. You can get used to it. Learn how to control yourself.
Oh, I like this comment from Lauren. But what if it's a cat and I'm literally throwing my socks at them? That is completely acceptable.
That's totally different. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I have thrown things at my cats. I mean, nothing really that would injure them, but just, you know, they're clawing on the screen, they're trying to knock over my glass, whatever it is, right? And I'm take something and take aim.
I guess I do have to throw in, look, there is a general principle in here from the whole philosophy thing, and that is if somebody can be unpleasant and even immoral, but if they're not being criminal, you can't deploy force in that circumstance. If you're the first to deploy force, that makes you the criminal, you the thug. So
makes you the bad guy. Yeah.
Yeah, you're the bad guy. So you respond to unpleasantness with adding distance. You respond to mere immorality, not criminality, with adding distance. If they become a thug, if they're opening up with the use of force on you, okay, respond with force and defend yourself. If you do that without them starting it, though, you're the thug, you're the criminal.
Right.
Don't do it.
Right.
All right, moving on. It's time for us to sign off from another episode of Philosophy in Action Radio. Thanks for listening. We hope you all had a great time.
I had a fantastic time. You know, I did think, I'll just note, that these questions were not going to take very long. Didn't I say that to you? And we'll have
you
plenty
did.
Of time for rapid fire.
We're going to have all this time for rapid fire. Sure.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. That's never happened before, by the way.
Oh my God. Well, I tell you, it's really hard to know. It just, I mean, I say this all the time, but it's really hard to know how in depth and how much I will have to say. Yeah.
There's always an interesting angle.
Anyway, mm-hmm. that's what makes the show fun. So I would hate to be like, no, my questions, I answered them all in 15 minutes and then we have 15 minutes for rapid fire, because it would mean that I wasn't getting into the intellectual depth that I really do enjoy about doing the show. So anyway, thanks for giving me interesting, hard questions that seemed a little bit easier on the surface. And also thank you to our generous contributors. With every episode of Philosophy in Action Radio, we bring you ideas that engage the mind and help you live better. Plus, we introduce thousands of other listeners to the principles they need to live virtuous, happy, and free lives. We think that's hugely important, and we depend on your support. So if you want to contribute, just go to philosophyinaction.com/support.
Excellent. Remember, we welcome feedback on what we're doing well and what we could do better, too. Just send the feedback to diana@philosophyinaction.com.
If you want to see what's on tap for the next few weeks, you can go visit philosophyinaction.com/upcoming. I have a ton of stuff scheduled right now, which hopefully I won't get all moved around because I'm talking too long on any particular question. But so that's at least the tentative schedule.
I'm Greg Perkins, and you can find me online at objectivismseminar.com. This show features Dr. Diana Shea, and you can read her blog, Noodle Food, at philosophyinaction.com/blog. Please drop by to submit and vote on questions for upcoming shows, and then join us live here at the same time next week at philosophyinaction.com.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.